On this vote, the ayes are 50, the nays are 48. The nomination of Brett M. Kavanaugh of Maryland to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States is confirmed. The Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the gallery.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and Brett Kavanaugh is the newest justice on the Supreme Court. Although the voting was almost entirely along party lines, there were some senators whose votes we were all watching, among them Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, and Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, and the only Democrat who voted to confirm Kavanaugh. Collins, who will be up for re-election in 2020, was a crucial swing vote in the Kavanaugh appointment, and she ultimately voted to confirm. Manchin is currently running for re-election in a state that Trump won by a 40% margin of victory. So where are the political realities each is facing in their own states? Joining us to discuss this is Emily Stewart, a reporter with Vox. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Jake Zuckerman, a political reporter with the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Hi, Jake.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So, Emily, I want to start with you. Senator Collins came out this weekend to defend her vote on Kavanaugh. Let's take a listen to what she said on CNN.
I do believe that she was assaulted. I don't know by whom, and I'm not certain when, but I do not believe that he was the assailant. So,
Emily, Collins is not up for re-election in November, but from what you've seen, what's the reaction been so far to her vote?
I mean, she's pretty popular in Maine, and this seems to have, at least for the time being, harmed her. Obviously, she's not up for election until 2020, so there's a lot of time between now and then, but people are disappointed. I mean, we'll see sort of what happens in the next several months and years, but I think that a lot of her constituents were disappointed, and more broadly, I think women around the United States who were looking to her to defend them are also disappointed in her.
Well, and they're not just disappointed, they're actually putting money towards funding her opponent. What have we seen about that so far? There's been a crowdfunding campaign to support whoever the opponent would be, whoever the Democratic opponent would be.
Right. So there's a crowdfunding campaign run by Be a Hero, which is the group founded by the activist Ari Barkin. And they've raised about $3.5 million to go toward whoever runs against her in 2020. And that is a big amount of money. I spoke with them over the weekend, and, you know, they said that that might be a game changer for whoever does decide to run against her or gets the nomination in 2020. Obviously, they're a little optimistic about that, but it's a lot of money that's already against her. And it also shows a lot of sort of what they describe rage donations and people trying to channel their anger and upsetness with this toward something more active.
Jake, let's move to West Virginia here, where Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat, is up for re-election this November in a very tight race in a very pro-Trump state. I'm imagining he's not getting rage donations, or his candidate is not getting rage donations, Jake.
Well, you know, I haven't seen any FEC numbers of late, but I can tell you that there's just a lot of deflation on the ground among progressives here in the state. And I think a lot of people are really wrestling with where do you go from here and what do you do. You know, I think that any sort of third party vote or any outside party vote is really just going to support a Republican candidate. And then there's this question of, well, is that the best option here? Is that the best way to go? Or do I just kind of want to hedge my bets and pick a guy who's with me sometimes who didn't come through for me last week?
But really, I mean, do you guys think this is going to motivate Democrats more or Republicans more? Or is it still a wait and see game, Jake?
I think more than, you know, a special amount of inflation from the vote, my guess is that you'd see some deflation among Democrats in that there's just not going to be the same excitement to go out and vote. Well, and I think that you have seen some Republican galvanization, say, and you see some people who are geared up. And in the end, there was this huge amount of Democratic energy here in West Virginia, and there were protests outside Manchin's office every day, and there were activists getting arrested outside his D.C. office and his Charleston office last week.
What about for Collins over here, Emily? Was there a similar reaction?
Yeah, I mean, you even see ahead of the vote where they had to shut down the hallway outside of her office, where she was getting coat hangers in the mail. I mean, there's been quite a bit of blowback here.
So we should be expecting a very exciting next couple of weeks, I'm assuming.
I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Jake, for you as well?
I would bet so, yeah.
Emily Stewart is a reporter with Vox, and Jake Zuckerman is a politics reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
During Justice Kavanaugh's Senate hearing, he put forward a theory regarding the origins of allegations of sexual assault.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
Among Americans, there is increasing concern that the Supreme Court is becoming a partisan and political body. And the recent controversy over Judge Kavanaugh's appointment, which included an FBI investigation, may only further divide the nation and its opinion of the court. Professor Barbara Perry is with us, and she's the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Dr. Perry, thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with some fundamentals. What is the role of the Supreme Court, Dr. Perry, and how has that role lined up historically with how Americans view the Supreme Court?
Sometimes the court and the federal judiciary are called the third branch. So when we think about their role, I often think of it as that third voice in our three branches of government.
And have Americans generally viewed the court as fair?
Yes, we have developed this image of the court that is above the muck and mire of daily politics.
Now, I'm going to make an assumption here, Dr. Perry, that that perception has greatly and drastically changed.
There's good news and bad news, I think, for the court in this realm after what we've just been through over the last few weeks. The good news for the court is that it almost always outpaces Congress or the president when approval ratings are taken. The bad news is, as we've just been saying, over these last few weeks, and particularly with the most recent controversy surrounding Justice Kavanaugh, it may be that the court will take a hit on that. But let's think back to Bush v. Gore in 2000. Polarized nation, polarized vote on George Bush and Al Gore. And the court polarized 5-4 in effect deciding Bush v. Gore in favor of Bush and giving him the presidency despite the fact that he had lost the popular vote. The court ended up with a 60% approval rating. And you say, well, how could that be? Polarization. 90% of Republicans polled agreed with the court's decision in Bush v. Gore. Only 30% of Democrats did, but the average was 60%. So we could find in this highly polarized time in which we live is that maybe 90% of Republicans approve of Judge Kavanaugh. Now maybe only 30% of Americans do, or maybe even less, but the court could still come out with a pretty high approval rating.
This, it could come out with a pretty high approval rating skewed towards the conservative slash Republican, you know, ideology here, I think. And I'm wondering if you've seen or recall a time when a nominee spoke so politically during a hearing, did a primetime television interview, and even wrote an op-ed in advance of the final confirmation vote, as Justice Kavanaugh did.
No, I can't. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but I can't recall it offhand. And I think that's because, as with all things in the era of Donald Trump, most of this was unprecedented. Now, people fought back, of course, to Clarence Thomas and the hearings 27 years ago over Anita Hill, and there were many parallels there. But the one parallel that didn't exist, that even though Justice Thomas, at that time Judge Thomas, was very upset in his second round of hearings about the Anita Hill charges of sexual harassment that were made against him, he didn't attack the senators. You could tell he was angry at them, but he didn't disrespect them, and he didn't make partisan statements like the ones that you played that Justice Kavanaugh gave.
Dr. Perry, what does the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh and, as you mentioned, Justice Thomas mean? I mean, these are two Supreme Court justices accused of sexual harassment or sexual assault. Women have testified, and that's not prevented these appointments from happening. So what message is this sending to American women who have now seen this happen twice?
That's unprecedented as well. We're living in the Me Too moment. We're living in certainly 24/7 media coverage, social media coverage, and the court has never been exposed in this way. It doesn't mean that the court has never been controversial. It has been going back to the founding and fights between the Jeffersonians and the Federalists over Supreme Court appointments, of all things. But we've never had a third of the men on the U.S. Supreme Court accused of sexual misbehavior, be that harassment or actually sexual assault. And that can't work in the court's favor.
You know, a lot of the controversy around Justice Kavanaugh has been focused on these allegations of sexual assault, his temperament, his alcohol use in his past. But one thing that's also come up is whether or not he will be required to recuse himself, particularly in light of the statements he made in his hearing, if the court receives a case about the president or Russia or anything related to that. Is that the case? Will he be required to recuse himself?
In a word, no. And the key is the concept of recusing himself. He cannot be recused. In other words, he would have to do that himself. It does happen. And in fact, when he was an associate justice, William Rehnquist recused himself from the infamous U.S. v. Nixon Watergate tapes case. Rehnquist had served in the Justice Department under Nixon, and so he took himself out of the case. On the other hand, Justice Scalia, who was good friends with Vice President Cheney, had gone duck hunting with him, in fact, did not recuse himself from a case involving the vice president during the Bush 43 era. So I think it's unlikely that Brett Kavanaugh is going to recuse himself from cases that could involve partisanship, that could involve things that he said in his most recent hearing, and certainly those instances in which President Trump is at issue.
That would lead me to believe that there is a large percentage of the population who will continue to not have as much faith in the Supreme Court as they once might have.
I'm afraid that could be the case. The court has been damaged, no doubt, by this controversy, just as it was damaged, I think, by the Clarence Thomas controversy. But the court moves on. These people serve, and this is what gets people upset at confirmation time, but these people serve for decades. Time marches on. People actually forget. And so I think that the court, as it has been described by Oliver Wendell Holmes, is the center of the storm, but it's a quiet at the center of the storm. And Justice Thomas has reported that when he arrived at the court, even after that most controversial hearing over the Anita Hill allegations, he was welcomed onto the bench by his new colleagues. And so the court tries to, again, go above the muck and mire of daily politics. And I suspect that as a body, as a corporate entity, it will do so. Whether the American people will see it that way is another story.
Barbara Perry is Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Dr. Perry, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Last Thursday marked a turning point for the life and career of playwright Dominique Morisseau. She was one of 25 people selected by the MacArthur Foundation to receive what's informally known as a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, a grant of $625,000 that recipients can use however they'd like over the course of 5 years.
It allows us to be able to practice our art and to have space and time to create new work without having to have the burden of figuring out where our income is going to be derived from. You know, we don't have to find supplemental jobs to be able to do the work that we do. We can actually just be the writers that we're sort of been pushing to be all of our careers.
Morisseau has already carved out an impressive career for herself, writing the Broadway-bound musical Ain't Too Proud about the Temptations and serving in the writer's room for the Showtime series Shameless. She's also authored a series of plays set in Detroit, a city that's central to her identity.
Well, I'm from Detroit. I was born and raised there. My husband's from Detroit. My family lives there. And so for me, Detroit is personal. It's about family. I always say that Detroit is also a metaphor for Black America in this country, and then therefore America at large, I think. So when people are looking at the city, we're sort of looking at the social narrative, a narrative around race and economics in our nation. And so for me, it's important to be writing about that and writing from a place of within I have so much love for the city because I have so much family there, and I had such a really particular upbringing there. And so I don't feel like Detroit has had a very human picture painted about it in terms of media exposure. And so for me, I want to be a narrator on the city that tells a more humane picture of our city.
In one of your most recent plays, you take on the issue that we're calling the school-to-prison pipeline, where children are essentially criminalized and at very young ages, and is something that's become a huge problem in the United States. How do you take a topic like that and bring it to the stage and keep audiences involved in such a heavy topic?
Well, first of all, I was an educator for many years, and I was raised by an educator. My mother was a teacher for 40 years in Highland Park, Michigan, which is I call it a sub-city inside of Detroit. And so because of that, I just have a vast knowledge about teaching. I've spent so much time in so many schools across New York City and all of, you know, the many public high schools and elementary schools. And I have a very close and personal relationship to teaching because of that, and to public school teachers and private school teaching. I've been in both. And so it looking at that topic, it's pandemic, really. And you have to look at it from really many angles. And so my play Pipeline is about looking at it through a mother who's trying to raise her son, but also a mother who's a teacher in a public school. So we get to see her relationship to the public school system, her son who goes to a private school and his relationship to that private school system. And we're looking at basically within the two forms of education, how institutions can fail children and educators, both in the public school, maybe infrastructurally, but in private schools, culturally. And both of those things are harmful to young people and can lead them to not having enough space for their total humanity and their emotionality as young, especially young Black and brown boys in our nation. And so that was important for me to try to explore.
Our producer who was putting this segment together found an interview that you had done with NPR, and here's where you say, I always say that we can't allow ourselves to be cherry-picked, you know, or to be the flavor of the month. Flavors come and go, and I think that it feels like we're being flavored right now as opposed to being institutionalized and grown up from the bottom up. And I think you were referring there to the opportunities that women of color specifically have within the creative field. Tell us a little bit about that. What do you see going forward as now a newly minted MacArthur Grant awardee, but also as a woman of color playwright?
Well, I think that change doesn't just look like putting people on the cover of things or on the brochures of things. It looks like infrastructural change. You know, you have to change leadership. And we're seeing that evidenced in large and small ways in our nation right now, right? Leadership, it comes from the top down. And so because that in theater in particular, it means programming is decided by leaders, you know, how a theater is run, how their marketing department is run, what kind of audiences they're bringing in. That's all decided by the institution. And so it takes people within that institution and leaders within that institution to have a very diverse background and for women of color to be in more positions of power and where they're making those decisions. And so I think we need to see a shift in that. So the work that I do as an artist, my work is on the stage, but it's not just on the stage. It's also off the stage because it's a time in the world where I feel that it doesn't make sense for me as a woman of color to have work about people of color and then there not to be people of color in the audience. There has to be an entire collective shift that invites audiences of diverse backgrounds into the house to have an experience together. That's what makes theater special, and that's what my work has to be the catalyst for.
And Dominique, I agree with you 100%, and I don't know how we make that change.
It starts first and foremost with community development. I think that there is an assumption about what people of color will and will not spend their money on, and that is by and large because people are not following the buying patterns of people of color. To suggest that we don't have the money or won't spend it on things that are this significant is false. I think it is also, it's about cultivating a relationship that makes people want to spend their money on something. That's what theater hasn't figured out. But I do also think affordability of tickets is a big deal, and that needs to be addressed in theater. There's too much of a disparity between ticket prices, especially when you're talking about Broadway. But the biggest thing, I think, is community development, which means you cannot expect people to come to you, leave their communities to come over to see something at your house if you are not ever willing to go to them. You have to be willing to take work out into their community, offer them something for free. I always use it in terms of like food. I say, you know, why would I leave my house where I know that I can cook? I have my food to come to your house and eat your food. And I don't even know that you can cook and you brought me zero samples. Like, why would I spend money to come to your house to eat your food? And I don't even know that I like your food. That doesn't make sense. You have to woo me. Give me some samples. Bring me out and show me that I'm not just a flavor, but somebody that you're really trying to cultivate a meaningful relationship with. That is the kind of thing that I think is missing and that we have to start doing and being way more active about.
Dominique Morisseau is a playwright whose work includes Skeleton Crew and Pipeline. Thank you so much, Dominique.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
We want to talk about how we define home in this country. Today in the United States is Columbus Day, a holiday where we're supposed to celebrate the quote-unquote discovery of the United States, despite the fact that natives lived here long before Christopher Columbus arrived. And the holiday gives rise to fundamental questions about ownership, citizenship, and what makes a place your home. And as we debate immigration and who belongs here, these questions have gotten increasingly complicated. My next two guests have thought a lot about this idea. Jose Antonio Vargas is an undocumented immigrant and author of the new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. He's also the founder and CEO of Define American. And Julissa Arce is author of Someone Like Me, How One Undocumented Girl Fought for Her American Dream. She was undocumented until 2009 when she got a green card and soon after her citizenship. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So I want to open this question to both of you. And maybe we can start with you, Jose. Who is it that gets access to this country? Who gets to have a piece of the quote-unquote American dream, a piece of the pie, a sense of ownership and belonging?
Well, it's a question of history, it's a question of laws, and it's the fact that you can't really separate the question of legality to the question of citizenship, right? I mean, it's interesting that you said that this idea of who gets to discover America, which is like the fundamental question, right? At Define American, we've been very, very intentional in making sure that we say that unless you're Native American or unless you're an African American, right, who was brought here through slavery, you came from somewhere. And it was just a matter of what laws you hit when you got here. I was listening to something about Bill O'Reilly. He likes to say that his great-great-grandparents immigrated to the U.S. the right way. Mm. And that always really struck me because it's part of this whole myth that there was a right way, even though, you know, back when he thought it was the right way, what happened was there was a potato famine and Irish people showed up in this country. There was no border patrol. There was no green card. There was no visa process, right? They showed up. That's why this question of who gets to be at home and who gets to belong and how we define American is really fundamental into the kind of understanding our own history.
Julissa, what about you? Who does get to have access in this country? Who gets a sense of ownership and belonging in the United States?
Yeah, so, you know, this is an interesting question for me because when I first came to the U.S., I went to Texas, to San Antonio, Texas. And in learning the history of Texas, I saw this quote recently that said, "The Americans have taken possession of practically all of the eastern part of Texas, in most cases without the permission of the authorities." And growing up in Texas and learning about the history of Texas, there was this real sense of pride that Texas had gained its independence from Mexico. And now as an adult, learning it not from the history books, but learning it through much broader lens, I've learned so many new things. For example, that even though there was this sense of pride about taking over without the permission and calling a place home because you felt a sense of belonging in that place, to me, that's what it means to belong, right? To find a home. And frankly, I felt American before I had a U.S. passport. That said, that I was.
Jose, tell us a little bit. You have a new book out. What are you sharing with the American public that's new about your story?
Well, you know, I publicly came out as undocumented more than 7 years ago. And the book for me really started because I didn't really want to write it. I resisted writing this for years. I figured I already come out in the New York Times more than 7 years ago. I've told my story. You know, I don't need to do this. And then the election of Trump happened, and I was living in L.A. I was living in downtown L.A., and the building manager of the apartment I was living in texted me about a month after the election and said, hey, I'm not sure if we can protect you if ICE showed up in the apartment building. It may be best for you and for us if you, you know, found another place. And so that got me really thinking about what's home. And then for a while, I actually really contemplated moving to Canada. At that point, I'd been in this country for, what, 23, 24 years?
And undocumented.
Undocumented. Yeah, I have not adjusted my status because there's no way. There's no line. And even marriage, even though same-sex marriage, I'm gay, even though same-sex marriage is legal now, because I had come out 7 years ago against the advice of lawyers who said that the moment you come out and say what you're going to say, we can't help you. There's no way, right? So I had to really think about home. So then this book kind of gave birth. And the fact that I had been spending more than 2 decades of my life living in this country, lying, passing, and hiding, it kind of gave me license to write about myself in a way that's way more personal than I had intended, but also in a way that speaks to the larger experience of what this feels like. Because guess what? The American public doesn't know what this feels like for the most part.
I would have to agree. And Julie, so what about your thoughts on that? What is it that the American public still doesn't get about what it is like to be undocumented in the United States?
I think that the number one question that I get is, why were you undocumented for 14 years? Why didn't you apply sooner? Why didn't you get in the back of the line? And I think what people don't understand is that that line that we often talk about, it's really a mythical place that doesn't exist. There isn't a line. You know, I was able to adjust my status because I got married. From a more emotional standpoint, I didn't realize and I didn't understand what it meant to be undocumented at age 14, which is when I found out I was undocumented. And it was days of not being able to sleep and days of not being able to think about anything else other than my immigration status. And so it does take a very big emotional toll on you. We have an incredibly resilient spirit, which makes it possible for us to be in this country for such a long time, being able to have lives despite being undocumented.
And I guess I would ask you both to close this segment. How do you define this idea of home? Is home the place that you came from? Is it the place that you end up in? Is it defined by the people you surround yourself with? What is home for both of you? Jose.
It wasn't until when I was writing this book, when I got arrested in Texas 4 years ago, back in the Obama era, when people weren't as angry as they were in the past few months because of the kids that were locking up in cages in South Texas. I was sharing a jail cell with boys ages 5 to about 14. And I had convinced myself that to be in this country from age 12 to at that point 33, that I had to earn being here. And it wasn't until I was in that jail cell that I actually concluded that home wasn't something I had to earn. I actually have a right to have a home in the same way that migration is a natural human right. It's why this country was founded, right? So home is not something I have to earn. And home is the people that I surround myself with, the people who make me feel at home, who define what home is and it, at this moment, and who defines what American is for people.
And Julissa, what about for you?
Yeah, I used to think that as soon as I became an American citizen, I could officially call American my home. And I've realized that I didn't need a passport to call America home, because even now that I do have a passport, people still want me to get deported, and they don't think that I'm good enough to be an American citizen, and people still tell me to go back to where I came from. And I've realized that the lifelong struggle of an immigrant is wanting to be in two places at once. When I'm in Mexico, I feel like I'm at home. And when I'm here in Los Angeles with my husband and my two cats, I feel at home. And I've stopped thinking of being an immigrant as something that is less than and something that is more than, because how beautiful is it that I get to call so many different places my home?
Julissa Arce is author of Someone Like Me, How One Undocumented Girl Fought for Her American Dream. Jose Antonio Vargas is author of the new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. And he's also the founder and CEO of Define American. Jose Antonio, Julissa, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Over the summer, the White House made a declaration. The nation's war on poverty was, quote, largely over and a success. This was part of the administration's argument for enacting stricter work requirements for public assistance. At the same time, unemployment is at 3.7% and the stock market is booming. So, is the war on poverty really won? Well, this week we're working with the Center for Public Integrity to check in on parts of the country that are still struggling with poverty. Our first stop today, Presidio, Texas. The small, poor border town depends on its relationship with Ojinaga, Mexico, just steps away across the Rio Grande. The town would also be directly impacted by the president's proposed border wall.
Well, as you've seen, border town life is not what they say in the news. You know, there's a lot of killings, and I'm sure there are some places that have really bad crime. But, I mean, living here, it's really quiet. It's, you know everybody.
Dave Leventhal is here to tell us all about this. He's the federal politics editor for the Center for Public Integrity, and he's the editor of its new six-part series. Dave, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you, Tanzina.
So what is Presidio, Texas like?
Presidio, Texas is sort of this idiosyncratic little city in Texas. I used to report from Texas. I've been there several times. And our reporter, Suhana Hussein, who spent some time this summer down there, found a place that really cut against the stereotype of what a border town is in the United States. And what I mean by that is that Presidio is incredibly dependent on its cross-border sister town in Mexico, Ojinaga, Mexico. And as a result, quite literally, people depend on Ojinaga for the basics of life, groceries, water, transportation, family. There's such a cultural connection, almost a symbiosis there, that were a border wall to be built, most of the people there feel as if the community would be not only cut off, but even killed by its own country. And they feel that the debate in Washington is a world away from the reality that they're living down there, which is very bleak and in high poverty, not a whole lot of crime, but certainly a lot of needs that they feel go well beyond a border wall. They don't want the wall at all.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, you said it's a high poverty area, going quite in contrast with what the administration announced this summer, that the war on poverty is largely over. What is the main concern for folks in Presidio? If it's not immigration, if it's not the wall, is it poverty or is it something else?
It's poverty, but it's also jobs, which I suppose the two are inextricably linked. It's health. A very odd twist in the story is that if you have an injury, if you're very sick and you need to get medical care, there's only the most rudimentary basic medical care available in Presidio, and you have to rely on the hospitals in Ojinaga to get critical medical care. Otherwise, you're going to be medevaced to a Texas city that, at minimum, will be an hour away, and if you really need serious care, it could be 4 hours away by cars. So as a result, people feel very isolated. They feel that Washington and the federal government, in a way, is not heeding their concerns. This is a place where, up until a couple of years ago, many of the streets were unpaved in the city, literally a dirt road town. So something that you would expect, not necessarily in Texas, but much more in Mexico. But the narrative has sort of flipped 180.
Why is this narrative? It's interesting that you mentioned the narrative. And in fact, for healthcare, Americans having to go across the border into to Mexico to get health care? I just want to make sure I understood that correctly.
That's true. And even for non-critical care, your dentist might be there. Certainly other sundries and daily necessities might be there, too. So health both in an acute situation, but also, too, in just keeping yourself fed, keeping your family fed, making sure that you have the basics of daily life. This is really the reality there. And if it becomes more difficult for the cross-border flow to flow, as it were, then that would be something that would be potentially disastrous in many of the minds of the people of Presidio were that to come to bear.
Oh, it also seems to, again, also fly in the face of the narrative that we need to, quote-unquote, build a wall when there's this type of symbiotic relationship going back and forth between these two communities. You know, Dave, you guys are looking at a number of different places around the country, and we'll be focusing on those throughout the week. But tell us why you chose the places you chose. What is it about these individual places that tells a story that's different about the nation's war on poverty?
You alluded to it earlier, but yeah, Donald Trump, as president, has taken a sort of victory lap this summer and into the fall, saying that, hey, the war on poverty has largely been won, that the economy is incredible, that the stock market is at its highest heights. And for many parts of the country, that is absolutely true, and people are doing extremely well, must underscore that. But there are places that feel incredibly forgotten, and that even though things might be great on one coast or another in this big city or that they are struggling. It might be an issue of education. We go to Yazoo City, Mississippi to tell an incredibly heart-wrenching story there. St. Louis, Missouri, where housing is such an issue on everyone's mind, or should I say the lack thereof. We go to a place like Standing Rock, the reservation in North Dakota, where people feel incredibly disenfranchised. All these places that we may have only gone to six, but are representative of many other places throughout the country, whether it's the mountains of West Virginia, maybe the rural parts of Florida, Gary, Indiana, Flint, Michigan. These are all places that are struggling, that have a reality that goes against what some leaders in Washington would like to have you believe.
Well, we've got about a minute left, and obviously we've just got a couple weeks left before the midterm elections. What could those elections mean for communities like Presidio?
Well, all of this is happening with the backdrop of the midterm election, and people have a choice to make. They're making it now in early voting in some states. They will certainly have the opportunity to make that choice in November come election day. So for places like this that are struggling, they face a big question too, which is whether they want to participate or even if they can participate. The reality for a lot of people is simply when you're working three jobs and just trying to make ends meet and keep your head above the poverty line, it's very difficult to participate in such a critical vote as the one that we're facing right now.
Dave Leventhal is the federal politics editor for the Center for Public Integrity and editor of this new six-part series. It launches tomorrow, and we'll have a link of it on our site, thetakeaway.org, and we'll be bringing you many more profiles of these communities in need all week. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.